And I've offered you an outline of my remarks. I won't read it exactly, but I'll stay with it, and I'll try to play it straight, because this is supposed to be an informative educational hour, not an entertainment. I'll just try to stick with my material, kind of, and I'll try to finish in time, but if anyone would have a very short question, we could answer it. Do we have refreshments tonight?
We have refreshments for both,
yeah. Well, I'll tell you, they're the same cookies we had a month ago. So. The box is dated, it says, sell by September the 5th, 89. I offer just a kind of a survey note, because this is not a talk on humor in general, but humor in the private. I mentioned how I became interested in the subject. It kind of was natural for me. I come from a kind of a humorous family. We weren't Christians. I wasn't a Christian until I was 18 years old, but we came from a humorous family. My folks laughed at things other people cried at. If my father was sober, which wasn't a lot of the time, but if my father was sober, he saw the happy side to everything. When he wasn't sober, that was another story. But my mother, likewise, was never pessimistic. And we were poor farmers in western Pennsylvania through the Depression years. And my mother could look up with no money and just kind of smile and say, well, the cows eat grass, we can eat grass. My mother had that kind of a philosophy. Mother and I were converted to the Lord Jesus on the same night in 1945, and that was when Christianity entered our home. But I'd like to tell you that they were a happy bunch before that. I guess they were not smart enough to know in what bad shape they were, but they were a happy bunch before that. And I remember years later when my grandfather, who was always a happy person, was dying with a very painful cancer situation that created giant coughs in him about every 4 or 5 minutes. It just would almost fall off the bed in great pain and anguish. But he would count the seconds in between coughs. He'd look up with a smile and he'd say, well, there were 4.5 minutes between the last cough. I'm now up to 4 minutes and 40 seconds. And then he would laugh and then he would cough. And then he'd say, maybe I'll set a longer record the next time. And up to within 5 minutes of his death, he was in that happy frame of mind. And then he kind of became unconscious for a few minutes, sat up in the bed and looked at everybody and said, well, goodbye. And looked back down with a smile and died. So I come from a long line of happy people. Ironically, I have looked sad most of my life. It's one of the problems. The face you have is the one you're born with, and it's hard to change it. And so I have always kind of looked sad, and I've had lots of people say, what's wrong with you? The only thing that was wrong with me was that I was so happy inside I had to conceal it externally so others wouldn't feel jealous. It made a difficult circumstance in life. So I've always been interested in humor. I've been interested in why we laugh and what makes us laugh. And although I'm not a professional in that, I've tried to make a kind of a study out of it. Because in my lifetime, I've often been called on to entertain, and you really need to know what makes people laugh if you're going to do that. I love to preach, but I'm not above entertaining once in a while. They're quite different. And if you go into a Germanic community and use the same humor that makes Italians laugh, nobody laughs. They think you're an idiot. Which, if you do it like that, that's what you are. So I've always enjoyed that sort of a circumstance. I haven't mastered it, but I've thought about it and read about it as much as I possibly could. And I became convinced a long time ago that the natural enjoyment that all mankind has for the ludicrous was not part of the fall. I have to believe that we were created in the likeness and image of Adam. He was created in the likeness and image of God. And it's hard to believe that anything that plays such a huge curative part in your life as humor would be created by the devil. You hardly think the devil is interested in making you feel that well, would you think? Well, I can't use logic like that, obviously. I'm not good at logic either. But I've just said to myself, this great sense of enjoying the ludicrous that everybody I've ever known possesses to some degree seems to be so much a part of the total aspect of everybody's being that it must be part of what God has given to us. And I've worked along that line. Probably no modern Christian preacher does as much along that line as Steve Brown. Does anybody know him or his name? See, I've never met him, never talked to him, but we're kind of on the same circuit in different directions. And he makes a great point of that particular thing. The concept of being able to laugh, the relaxation that does you, and how people who often become very depressed, the one thing they miss is a laugh. Every now and then somebody go crazy and laugh all the time. But the concept is they miss that. I had a psychiatrist friend in New Jersey. He said, if people are really depressed, if they just laugh, he said, He said, they just whistle. He said, it would do them a world of good. And they look at me, and nothing but laugh out here. So I just said to myself, the concept of enjoying the ludicrous or a sense of humor has got to be more than something the devil did when he knocked us down. And we know that there's devilish humor, too, and all that sort of thing. But as I say in these notes, can you, and I'm not sure this is scientifically accurate, and Ibri ought to be more careful in this, but can you think what Adam looked like when he saw the duck-billed platypus for the first time? Can you imagine, and it is an imagination, but can you imagine, do you know what a duck-billed platypus looks like? Look one up in your dictionary when you get home. It's just hard to imagine Adam looked at that and said, my. What a perfectly normal being, whatever language he spoke in. I kind of think, yes, this tailor's a man. He must have looked at him and said, what is that? Who stepped on that thing's nose? Or something like that. Proboscis, maybe. But whatever the case happens to be, I've kind of felt that way. So that's how I became interested in the subject. I'm not often given an opportunity to talk about it, but Ibri is a strange kind of colloquial. And for the last several years, I've kind of been the literary man in the... There are others, no doubt, but I've kind of been that. Dr. Phillips examines the stars. Dr. Studenroth takes apart the grass. Dr. Newman looks at all sorts of phenomena in space and other things like that. Mr. Zimmerman looks at the inner soul and the conscience of man to determine why pathologically he has a split personality. And among the world of all these scientists, you need some balance. And I've kind of been part of that balance. I talk about literary heroes and that sort of stuff because it's the interdisciplinary biblical research institution, and you've got to have something from the social sciences to keep the regular scientists down at some level where they live with the rest of the people. You've got to do it. So I thought that this spring I'd talk about humor in the Bible. And Dr. Newman said, don't you want to write a bigger description of it than that? And I said, well, I know that I want to, but it takes time to write those descriptions. Sometimes it takes longer to write the definitive statements about the talk than it does the talk. So I said, just put that down. And he put it down, and that's where we are tonight. Well, what is humor in the first place? You'll find that I'll stick with these notes pretty closely. I plan to finish on time. If I don't, I'll just quit. We quit at 9. That's what we do. And if I can make it by 10 seconds of 9, I'll have time for that short question. But something like that. What is humor? I always start with the dictionary on these things. And when you get away from the medieval idea that humor was a fluid in your body, and stuff like that, when you get into modern understandings of humor, it's the quality which appeals to the sense of the ludicrous or absurdly incongruous. Incongruous means that a thing is out of harmony with what you expect it to be. Absurdly means that it's very out of harmony with what you expect it to be. Now, it's easy to be offensive accidentally. And I don't want to be that. I'm about to give you an illustration. And I don't want it to be, if it's offensive, please forgive me or tell me later or something like that. But one morning, I was on a trip on a Sunday morning early. I was due to preach someplace at 9 o'clock. I was alone in a motel. I got up about 6 and looked over my sermon and a few other things. Turned on the television to see if I could catch anything, and just like that. And here there was a gospel quartet, brother. When they hit that, they were going with "The Storm Passes By" for the 15th time. I just love that kind of music, so I listened to them. And as soon as they were done and 6 announcements were over, a man came forward to preach. Well, I'm not hostile to listening to preachers on television, if they're good. He came forward to preach, and he started out, I can't tell you exactly how he started out. That's why I don't want to irritate you. But he started out something like this. He said, many people are sick and many are ill because they don't trust God enough. That's probably right. But he then moved into a more definitive implication that if you're born again, you shouldn't be sick. He said it in pretty forceful language. So I listened to him for a minute, and then I began to laugh to myself. And after I laughed to myself for a couple of minutes, I began to laugh out loud. There was nobody there, but I was the only one there. And you know what I was laughing? Of course you don't know what I was laughing at. But I was laughing at something that was absurdly incongruous because he was wearing glasses. I don't mean to be offensive. Did I tell you that? But when a man who says if you really trust God, you shouldn't be sick, is saying glasses while he wears it, that is absurdly incongruous. That's out of harmony, see? Now, maybe he was just wearing them so the rest of us would feel good, but when he leaned forward, I saw he was also, on the top of his head, going bald. And I said, what? I said, what? He's going to heal me, but he's wearing glasses and he's going bald? And then deep in my soul, a little voice said, I wonder if he's got false teeth. I couldn't answer that, but, you know, I couldn't explore on that. But that's the absurdly incongruous. Hope you understand that. And I don't mean it in an offensive way. He might have been a great brother if I'd had a chance to go fishing with him and all that kind of stuff. But I was struck by it, and so that's what humor is. It's the quality which appeals to a sense of the ludicrous or absurdly incongruous. That's what it does. When I went down south to go to college, I was away from home for the first time in any extended period. I lived on a little farm in western Pennsylvania. I spent a few nights with my grandparents, but other than that, I was home every night. Boy Scout camp 1 week, I think. But I was away at college, 600 miles from home, and I was a free spirit, and I was interested in being myself, which was really kind of dumb. I was really very young. And one of the things that I did, which endeared me to the heart of the local town, was that in the driving rainstorms, I often walked through town with an umbrella that had no cloth on it. I visited there 5 years ago and went into a restaurant. We sat down to eat, and the woman who ran the restaurant was Sis somebody or other. Sis can barely move now, but I said, hello, Sis. She looked at me and she said, you still got that umbrella? Someone walking in a rainstorm with an umbrella with no cloth on it is absurdly incongruous. Or it's the mental faculty of discovering, expressing, or appreciating the ludicrous or the absurdly incongruous. That's what humor is. Humor is not just telling jokes. Humor is not just being funny. Humor is seeing and appreciating that which in life is out of harmony with the normal pattern of reality. A lot of jokes are really not humorous. They're meant to harm and smash things. And a lot of witty sayings are not all that witty. They're meant to put people in their place. I'm not saying those things are devoid of humor, but humor is a good thing if properly applied, because in all of life there's a lot that's incongruous, and it relaxes you tremendously just to see it. And my dad used to say, if you don't have anything to laugh at, Tom, go and look at yourself in a mirror. He had lots of sayings like that. And that ought to amuse you somewhat, he said, along that way. My father did not have the benefit of the Dobson lectures. He's long been with the Lord, but he didn't have that benefit, and I speak well of him or want to speak well of him, but he said to me, you know, there are only two ugly people, and when I die, you'll be alone. In the Dobson business, you're not supposed to do that, you know? You're not supposed to do that. So that's what the dictionary says. One of the books that I've worked with in humor over the years, which I footnote here, I kind of pieced together his definition. He didn't have it in one point. I kind of had to wrap it out of several sections. He says that humor is observations based on the reality of a life setting. So we don't tell jokes or we don't make humor about things that nobody knows exist. You know, like saying, there were three planktons in Mars once. It doesn't make sense. It's based on the reality of a life setting in which the incongruities of the ambiguous are seen and appreciated. See how hard it is to define a simple word like humor? But that's the concept of it. And the good humor, as I see it, takes a life setting, makes the most of it. It excludes foolishness and silliness and senselessness. It excludes those things which we are forbidden in Ephesians 5:4 and page 2. It excludes those things because they're not based on a life circumstance. I remember once in a class, a bunch of us got giggling about nothing. Well, we got giggling about a really stupid thing you really couldn't call it. Fun and humor are not always the same, you know. But we got giggling about nothing. We were giggling like a bunch of kids, but we were a bunch of men in seminary. We got giggling. Just giggling. Grown men. Whole rows. Well, one of the professors sat in the front row. And it was late in the afternoon, and he was tired. And we had a lecturer lecturing who spoke English rather poorly and Swedish rather well. So it was Dr. Hedegaard, you'll remember. He was a great teacher and a fine Christian man. But his English was about what my Spanish is, you know, an un poco abo or something like that. And you stopped at that point. What a great man. And so in the front row, one of our other professors sat to interpret for him when he needed him, if he needed a word. But that professor was having a tough time because it was a long afternoon, it was warm in there, and the sun was shining in the window, and he would nod forward in a situation like that, looking at his notes more closely, no doubt. Nod forward in a situation, and then all at once he'd snap to, and he'd wake up, and he'd look right at the... And he'd start. So one of the fellows in Iro said, I'll bet you that he's a secret sun worshiper, and they don't know it at the seminary. Look, his head is going down with the sun. Now it's coming up with the sun. Can you see the ludicrousness in that situation? Well, among ourselves, it was kind of humor, but if you tried to tell somebody else, they'd think you were out of your tree or off your limb or something like that. So bad humor brutalizes life. Bad humor looks at you and says, oh, you're too fat. You're too fat. Look, he's too fat. Wretched humor. It's really not humor at all, although you have to keep these categorizations good, bad, and things like that. Bad humor tends to ruin people, and it sometimes causes great hurt to people. I was invited to a fellow's home one day, and after preaching on Sunday, and when he walked in, he said, well, he said, I hope you're not expecting much to eat. He said, my wife burns water. In the corner of my eye, I saw that his wife was not laughing. And I knew that what he meant for humor, in his own crude way, was not making her feel good. So I didn't laugh either. I didn't know what to say either. I felt like going out to a restaurant. Most of us think that scorn is not humor either. In some of the books on humor in the Bible, you pick up, they quickly point out that in Psalm 2 it says, God will hold, he'll laugh, he'll hold them in derision. But I've never thought that was humor. I thought that was the scorn of God's anger. And you'll see it in passages like Psalm 37:13, too. Although I've never argued over that or split any church over it. But most of us don't think that scorn is humor. There's a laughing scorn. It's like when a student comes in with his paper late and he says, I'm sure there'll be no deduction on this, Dr. Newman. And Dr. Newman goes, ha, 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 ha. It is not a humor situation, see. It's a laughter and scorn. Of course, he doesn't laugh like that. He goes, ha, ha, ha. So I've been prone to say that when people say, well, there's a lot of humor in the Bible because it says God laughs, that generally is a laughter in scorn or in derision of the evil plans of men who defy God. And that's like God stomping on them in a sort of way. But I think there's lots of humor in the Bible, and I will get to it in a couple of minutes. Well, how's humor given on page 2 at figure 3? Well, for most of us, it's given in fabricated stories, which we tend to call jokes. And they can be humorous. A fellow said to me once, he said, you'll never find Jesus telling any jokes. And because I was feeling snappy, I said, yes, and you won't find him brushing his teeth either. A lot of things you won't find Jesus doing because, of course, we have rather short biographical accounts of the totality of his life and ministry. But the main vein for humor is highlighting the incongruities of life, and we do that in jokes. So my wife tells about the two women that got to heaven. And the one said to the other, she said, my, she said, isn't it beautiful here? And the other woman said, yes, and just think, if we hadn't eaten that oat bran, we could have been here 3 years ago. See, that's highlighting the incongruities of life, that you would be out of harmony by the diet you eat with the plan of the sovereign God. So humor does that. That's kind of a story type of joke. And it concentrates on the ridiculousness of a situation or the ludicrousness of a situation. I've been trying to make other nouns out of the word ludicrous, like ludicrousiosity. I've misspelled it several times in these notes. It's not because I don't know how to spell it. It's because my fingers don't work well on the keys. And I don't bother to go back and proofread this stuff. Are you kidding? This lecture is free. Go back and proofread all this stuff? So that main vein is highlighting the incongruities of life. But in the Bible, the major means for conveying these incongruities are not jokes, but they work along two lines. I've kind of used these topics. I've borrowed them from somebody else, but a lot of guys don't agree, so just don't worry too much about that. But along two lines. One, literary genre, that's the big word in Bible societies today. If you can't say genre just right, they'll think you're an ignoramus of a high degree. Literary genre, or types of literature, and literary devices. In literary genre, I mentioned three basic varieties. There are others, and you could add, you know, you can multiply entities almost till Occam couldn't get them with his razor. But anyhow, in a philosophic joke. But in Ecclesiastes 9, there's what I refer to as a story. Now, a story does not mean a thing is bad. And had a student in New Testament a couple of years ago, when I referred to a parable as a story, he said, well, he said, I don't like to hear the parables called stories, because he said, when somebody says that, he said, I think right away, what's your story, Buster? What's this, what's that, and what's that? And it caught me at a bad moment, because I have silly days that may or may not be humorous. I said, oh, I said, do you really think that? I said, well, listen to this. And I began this way. I said, tell me the old, old story, tell me. And I went through about 10 different hymns like that, while the rest of the class sat there and thought I was having a fit. And after a while, he shrunk down his chair. He said, no, no, no. Because, see, we use the word story in a good time thing. Tell me the story of Jesus. Wonderful story of love. We use it in a good way. Nobody thinks we're telling lies in that particular situation. So stories, here in Ecclesiastes 9, is a fascinating short story. Verse 14. There was a little city and few men within it, and there came a great king against it and besieged it and built great bulwarks against it. You see the plot of the story? A little place, a big army around it, and it's really in tough shape. There aren't many men to defend it, and outside is a great king. But in that city, there's a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. Story ends. Stop and say, you say, that's humorous? Yeah, that's humorous. In a way, it's humorous, because it points out the incongruity of life. That in life, the man who's right often doesn't get the reward. And every time I read it, I smile inwardly, and I remember what Jeremiah said to Baruch in chapter 45 of that book. He said, don't seek great things for yourself. I remember that and say, well, if the poor wise man was only interested in helping the city, then he'll feel well rewarded. But you know immediately that 10 years after the battle was over, they erected a monument, not to the wise man, but to the generals of the army. Nobody knew his name. And that is humorous, believe it or not, because there's an incongruous nature. Not a joke, but it's a story that concentrates on the incongruity of an absurd situation in life. Wouldn't you think that the guy who came up with the big plans, wouldn't you think that he'd be the guy that everybody remembers? Well, I will tell you right now that the men who devised the system of electronics that made the Patriot missile success, I can tell you right now that not one of you knows any of their names. I'm fortunate to know one of their names because I met the father of this guy who described in detail and his son later some of the work that they'd done. And not electronically, the work they'd done. But I'll guarantee you that no one in Israel knows one of their names. But they all know Schwarzkopf's name and Bush's name and a bunch of other names and Hussein's name. They all know those names. So that's a kind of a humor that people sometimes miss. And the humor behind it is that if you think you're always going to be rewarded in life the way you want to be, you better just sit back and look in the mirror and laugh at yourself for a little bit. But there's really a beautiful one in the situations. Now, the difference in situations and stories is purely in the mind of the guys who make up outlines. But in my mind, the situation is a lengthened thing which tracks out a lot of history. And this one in Esther 6 is just a beautiful example of humor in the Bible, as the Bible conveys a major theme by pointing out the incongruities. It is a beautiful one. You have to start it back in chapter 5, at verse 14. Esther has the longest verses, so in 5 and 14. And this is Haman's wife speaking to Haman. Then said Zeresh his wife and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak thou unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet, and the thing pleased Haman, please, Haman. And he caused the gallows to be made. I can see the smile on his face right now. Make it 50 cubits high, and go into the king tomorrow. Tell him you'd like to hang Mordecai, and hang Mordecai. I can see it. It pleased him. I can see the smile on his face right now. Well, so the next day he gets ready to go see the king. But in the providence of God, you're reading the situation. In the providence of God, while Haman is having gallows built, the king is trying to sleep, and he can't sleep. And so he decides to get up and read the records of the heroic deeds that he's done in years past so he can maybe sleep better. But in the process of reading that, he reads how two of the chamberlains planned to kill him and somebody snitched on them, that's not a good word, somebody told what was happening and his life was saved and those men were punished. And the king says to his servants, he said, did we ever do anything for this guy? And they say, not that we know of. Well, here comes Haman in the court. He's coming in to ask that Mordecai be hung, you know, the gallows. And he's coming in. Here he comes into the court, and the king says, who's out there? And it's Haman that's out there. And the king says, let him come in. And he comes in. He's coming in the favorite. And the king says to him, what should be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor? Now, if you can't see the beginning of a humorous situation, then you are dead already. What should be done to the man that the king delights to honor? What should be done to him? And Haman thinks it is her. Who would the king like to honor more than me? So he doesn't ask about hanging Mordecai. He wants to get what he thinks he's going to get. So he says, I'll tell you, king. He says, you ought to take that fella. You ought to put him on the king's horse. You ought to put him in the crown royal. You ought to put him in the royal apparel. You ought to lead him through the city in honor. And in front of him, someone will go and say, look at the good things that are done to the man that the king honors. That's what you ought to do. And the king said to Haman, hurry up, get all that stuff, and do that to Mordecai the Jew that sits in the gate. See, it's not a joke, but it's a very, very humorous situation. And you know, the killing of people isn't funny, but the attendant circumstances are sometimes kind of funny. Haman, his jaw must have dropped a yard. He had nothing to do but to do it. It would be stupid at this point to say, I'd like him hung. Don't you think? Don't you think he couldn't say that? So he goes and he gets Mordecai, and he takes Mordecai and leads him through the city, and then he goes home and goes home mourning, covers his head, and he says to his wife, he said, look at the things that happened to me. And they really comfort him. His wife says, listen, if Mordecai is in the sea of the Jews and you start to fall before him, you're in big trouble, brother. You're in big trouble. You can pursue that a step further, but I can't tonight because the fidgeting of tempest always keeps us bothered, say, but it's a situation. The Bible conveys humor by showing the absurdities and the incongruousness of an ambiguous situation. Ambiguous because Haman comes before the king. You don't know what's going to happen. We've read the whole story. Now, we do, but you don't know what's going to happen. These Persian kings, and particularly this one, are despots that you can't predict what they'll do. So whatever the case happens to be, it's humor in a situation. And then in the aphorisms, or maxims, or short sayings, or clever things, as in Proverbs 26, a whole bunch of them in Proverbs 26, 11 through 17, and many other places. The book of Proverbs is loaded with them. But a lot of times we read them, and we don't think of them as humor at all, because we're looking for a big guffaw, maybe. But I've always enjoyed these. See in Proverbs 26, 13? Well, you can start a long way back. But at 13, the slothful man says there's a lion in his way, and the lion, that's good, that's the way it goes. Am I in the right chapter? Yes, okay. Every now and then, see, that's what happens to me. Wind up in the wrong chapter. As the door turns upon the hinges, so does the slothful turn upon his bed. You just have to think about that for a moment. Does the door turn upon its hinges? You've got to push the thing. Does the sluggard turn on his bed? You've got to go over and roll him out. It's like calling your kids for school in the morning. The slothful hides his hand in his bosom. It grieves him to bring it to his mouth again. The sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason. Boy, have I seen that in the classrooms from time to time. Sluggard is wiser in his own conceit. I remember arguing with a fellow one day on a subject I didn't know anything about. That happens a lot. But I didn't know anything about it. And he said in a tired way after a while, he said, it's amazing how somebody that doesn't know much can confound the minds of those that do, he says. So at that particular point, we both chuckled. Note verse 17. He that passeth by and meddleth with strife, and it doesn't pertain to him, is like a guy who grabs a dog by the ears. Well, try that sometime. because of course, I guess it would depend on the dog and how long the ears were. On a basset hound, maybe you could hold it like that. But try that sometime. The dog will tear you to shreds. And the writer goes on that way. Proverbs is full of humor in contrast and aphorisms. And I'll come back and touch some of them later. But that we call literary genre. And to that you could add riddles, and you could probably add puns, although I usually put them with wordplay. But there are a few other things you could add too. Things in the scripture that are tended to point out the incongruities of life so that you relax and you enjoy them. You don't look at them with a big... You enjoy them. That's what you do. They're literary devices. Well, if you read five different books, they'll list these in different ways. So I've broken them down into general sense. And I'll mention them pretty quickly. The speech figures. Now, they're not just used for humor. They're used for everything from ordering bread at the store to arguing with your friends. But the speech figures, the metaphors, and the similes. The simile extends itself into a parable. Now, I've noted the one in Luke 7, 31 through 35. In Luke 7, 31 through 35. Matthew, Mark, Luke 7, 31 through 35. The Lord says, what am I going to liken this generation to? That's an extended simile. What am I going to liken this generation to? A stated comparison. What are they like? Well, they're like children sitting in the marketplace and calling one to another and saying, we've piped unto you and you've not danced. We've mourned to you and you have not wept. You have to stop and see it in the background of your mind. You have to see a bunch of kids, half of them refusing to cooperate with the other bunch. John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine. You say, he's got a devil. The Son of Man comes eating and drinking. You say, behold, a gluttonous man, the wine bibber. And you say, well, that doesn't sound funny to me. It doesn't sound funny. It sounds humorous. It shows you the incongruity of life that when one man comes eating and drinking, they say, when he comes eating and drinking, he's got a devil. Another man comes eating and drinking, and they say, well, you know, he's just a glutton. He's just a drunkard. And the incongruity in life is their unwillingness to deal with both on the same level or on the same line. And that's humor. It will make you smile if you think about it. Lots of people never think about it. They're so anxious to get done with the daily Bible reading that they can't see a good note no matter what happens. But it will do it like that. I mentioned likewise the elaborations. If you want to look at metaphors, you'd have to go. I mentioned in my notes, in the handwritten notes, the magical ones that appear in the page that you don't have. I mentioned also in Ezekiel 17, Ezekiel 5. In Ezekiel 5, where he's cutting all the hair off his head and dividing it up, a demonstration of what will be the future of the Jews in times of persecution. That is a humorous sort of thing. And if you don't think it is, then come into the building tomorrow with a razor. Stand out in the hall and shave your head. And start throwing your hair out. This is what's going to happen to Parth. You will have a ring of students laughing at you like you and hardly believe. You would hardly believe it. Or try just lying in the hall on one side for a long time, you know. You'll discover what the humor of the situation is, the incongruity. I mentioned the elaborations. The hyperbole is where you exaggerate a thing to a great length. Not to tell a lie, but to make it big. And it may be used for humor, it may be used for just matter-of-fact stuff. And litotes is the opposite, where you tone a thing down. I'll mention an example of them a little later when I talk about some former passages in the Bible. Then you get into the word plays. Personification, where you talk to a thing. You talk to the tree like it's real. You talk to it like the man in 1 Kings 13 who looks at the altar and says, oh, altar, altar. He speaks to it as if he expects it to hear an answer back. And many similar passages. And the oxymoron is a super dull guy in which words that have opposite meanings are put together like the cruel love expression and that sort of thing. And terribly good. And we use terrible today different than what you use terrible. How is that pie? It's terribly good. That's really... If you went back 200 years ago, you could have the pie thrown at you for that. I've seen some pies that I kind of wish were thrown at me. Instead of one piece, you got the whole pie, that pie. And the onomatopoeia, the thing that sounds like it is, that's very humorous. I'm no longer teaching subjects in a seminary, but when I was teaching Hebrew exegesis, we always got a laugh in Hebrew ex and Lamentations. It sometimes took... We always got a laugh when I would say, see, the title of this book is Ikkar. You can hear the anguished Jew outside Jerusalem saying, Ikkar, you can say it. Ikkar. And that's exactly what it is. We translated Lamentations from the Latin, the Septuagint, and all that kind of stuff. But if you work more literally in Hebrew, you'd say ouch or how or what or something like that. I'm not a great Hebraist. I was in a meeting where a great Hebraist lectured one time, and that's what he would say every time things seemed to go wrong. He would look up at the ceiling and he would go, Akka! Where are you? It's like doing a few Akkas yourself. On page 3, the narrative continues with irony, of which I will say very little, and I'll mention a couple of patterns later. Irony has lots of subforms, like satire and sarcasm. I had a learned friend who knew that the word sarcasm was developed from the Greek word sarx, meaning flesh. He said, I can't believe the Bible would ever have anything that was like the flesh in it. There are guys who build up ideal arguments along that line. But I'll tell you, there's some high sarcasm in the Bible, but it's not intended to irritate, cut, and kill people. It's intended to draw truth out. And in the long run, that becomes one of the great values of humor. It tends to set a truth into a setting which is more pleasant and more palpably received. That's the great value of humor. It tends to make you look at a thing in a relaxed manner. The next thing you know, it bites you by the nose or something like that. So irony is a big thing, and I shan't go into detail on it. Puns and fables, I mentioned those in a general sense, just rounding that out. So that's how humor is presented. But the big question in figure 4 on page 3 is how do we see humor? And that's where we fail. That's where we fail. We fail. We fail, when I say we, you may not, I may not, we may all be above this in this room. But that's where many people fail. We don't read the Bible with feeling and empathy. I, once in Ivry, a long time ago, and reviewed the novels of Chaim Potap up to that time. Since then, Potap has written two or three more. I can't remember when it was, but he's written two or three more, which I have also read. And I enjoyed his writings. He's a Jewish writer with a background in Hasidic Judaism. But I've always enjoyed his writings. They're good books. They're good book stories. They're not study books. They're stories. So I enjoyed reading them very much. But what I always observe is if a person who sits down to read a book says, well, I've got to read it. Well, it's been at least 15 minutes. Where do we start? He never sees the good points in books. So when I get ready to read Potap, see, I almost lick my lips. I've got other things I have to do, too. I can't just read novels, but I lick my lips. And I only read novels once. I read them once, and that's it, if I can, etc. But when I got the last Potap novel, I could hardly wait to read it. In fact, I didn't want to read it too fast because I wanted to enjoy it. I don't mean read the word. I didn't want to get through it too quickly. I usually read 10 or 15 minutes at night sitting in the bathtub. I like to do that. You don't have to enjoy those things. I like to do it. It's relaxing to me. You read till the water gets cold. Late at night, when you get out. But I would be so eager to read it, I could imagine, you know, I'd start imagining in the middle of my evening work what I would read that night. Now, if I would bring that attitude to the Bible, I would get a lot more out of my Bible reading, and I would see a lot of humor in the Bible. But a lot of us who read the Bible read it kind of grudgingly. Somebody told us if we didn't read 10 chapters a day, we'd have a low place in heaven, or a longer time in purgatory, or something like that. And consequently, when you see people reading the Bible, a lot of times, I don't mean to sound so critical, but a lot of times they show the enthusiasm for it that the guy who's going to be hung shows for the gallows. Don't argue with me on that. I just walked through the library and watched. You hardly ever see a guy say, wow, I can hardly wait to get the next chapter. Taylor only wants us to do 10 chapters today. Can't I do 11? You hardly ever see that. So the thing is, on concerning seeing Bible, is you have to come to the Bible knowing that it's full of these things, and you have to come reading it from that point of view. I haven't written my notes, but you come with a happy outlook. You read with an eye to the unreal or the exceptional. For example, in 1 Kings 22, 14 through 28. I can't read that whole section, and many of you may know that. But that's the section where Jehoshaphat and Ahab are thinking about going up and making war on Ramoth-Gilead. Ahab wants to go up. Jehoshaphat doesn't know if he should go or not. He wishes there were a prophet of God there to help him. And there's a prophet of God in prison, so they go and get him, and they bring him out. And when he comes out to meet them, in the connection with verse 13, 1 Kings 22, that prophet looks at the king, and he says, let thy word, I pray thee, be like the word of one of them, and speak. And Micaiah looks at the king, and he says, as the Lord liveth, what the Lord saith to me, that will I speak. And so he came to the king, and the king said to him, shall we go in battle? And he looked at the king right in the eye, that reading in a text. He answered, and he said, go and prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into thy hand. And the king said unto him, how many times shall I charge you that you tell me nothing but that which is true in the name of the Lord? I'm sorry to read it that fast, but you get the feeling of that? The king said, shall we go and fight? And the prophet said, yeah, go and fight. Go and fight. The Lord's going to deliver it into your hand. Go and fight. And the king said, how many times have I told you to tell me the truth? Wicked wretch never wanted the truth in his life. But he caught, can you catch the prophet's words? Now, you can call that sarcasm or irony, what you will, but the prophet said something that is full of humor. The incongruity of the situation is that he says to the king, go and fight, but it's obvious that he doesn't think the king is going to win. And the king, the discussion goes on many verses, and the king says, take this guy and put him into prison. And he said, feed him the bread and water of affliction until I come back again. Do that for him at the end of this long narrative. And the prophet says to the king, verse 28, he says, if you come back at all again, the Lord hasn't spoken by me. That's a kind of a final note, too. The king says, you keep him and feed him. The prophet says, buddy, if you come back again, then I was wrong right from the start. And of course, he doesn't come back. We don't know what happened to the prophet, either. He might still be there eating bread and water of affliction. We don't know what happened to the prophet. So you read with an eye to the unreal in a situation. See, it's a real circumstance. The king is there. He wants the advice. But you read with an eye to see what in it may not be real to a situation or exceptional. And what's not real is the attitude of the prophet. because the words say, go and battle. But that's not what he said. He said that in such a way that the king knew it. I used to hear Dr. McRae lecture on that, so I hope I'm not far off. But that's what he said very emphatically. And then I mentioned that you have to adopt the perspective of the person in the account. Try Judges 9. Try Judges 9. At verse 7 through 21. Judges 9. This is after the death of Gideon. And they're looking for some new person to rule the territory. And the circumstances are that Jerubbaal, Gideon, is dead. And they want somebody to rule the territory. And they go in and make Abimelech, one of his sons, to be king. He's not going to do him much good. And they tell it to Jotham. They tell it to Jotham, this difficult son of Gideon's. They tell it to Jotham. And he went into the top of Mount Gerizim. He lifted up his voice and he says, listen to me. Listen to me, guys. And then in verse 8, he starts a long account. He says, the trees went forth on a time to anoint a king over them. And they said to the olive tree, reign over us. The olive tree wouldn't do it. Then they went to the fig tree. Verse 10, he wouldn't do it. And then they went to the vine, and the vine said he wouldn't do it. And the vine said, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to leave these things. And so then they went to the bramble, the thistle maybe, the nastiest of all bushes. And they said, come and reign over us. And the bramble said, yeah, I will. You know, you anoint me king, and I'll reign over you, and I'll do what you will. And then he says, if you've done truly and sincerely in that you've made Abimelech king, you're going to find out what it's like to be ruled by a thistle. But the humor is just loaded in a situation like that. You can almost see them. But it's not a joke. It's the absurdity of life being drawn out that they can look at it and see it and grip it. My guess is they didn't understand it then, but I think I look back on it today that way. And so you watch for the emphasis and meanings of words in the third place that are understood emotionally. I mentioned Job 16:2. Job 16:2, where you have a good example of an oxymoron, in case you're not sure what kind of a moron that is. Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. Troublesome comforters are ye all. King James says miserable. You can handle it several ways. Miserable, a comforter is not to be a miserating factor, but a helpful. Miserable comforters ye all, he says. And every time I read that, I smile. I don't give a guffaw, but I smile. And I say, yeah, that's not what they were comforters, but they were miserable comforters. And a miserable comforter is a contradiction in terms that proves that the end of what they want to accomplish can't be achieved. So you read through that. You read through the Bible looking for those things, and you remember that humor is the role of using the ludicrous in a way of highlighting the truth. And I shan't read the passage in Luke 13:32, but that's where Jesus speaks of Herod, and he says, you go and tell that fox. You go and tell that fox. That's a speech figure. Herod did not have claws and a furry tail at the time. But he says, you go and tell that fox. And because of the nature of literature and the knowledge of the fox, you can bet everybody there smiled and said, fox, except maybe some of Herod's guys. Everybody smiled and said, fox, crafty, clever, sneaky, wretched animal out in the vineyard trying to get the grapes. Maybe they haven't read Aesop, but you better believe that everybody worked that way. So when you read through the Bible to see the humor, you don't say, well, this is like Abner's joke book. No. You read through to see where the incongruous is presented in a way to draw our attention to a truth, and it makes us smile. Sometimes you'll chuckle, sometimes you'll actually laugh, depending on the mood you're in. But if you don't come to the Bible in a reverent and happy state, then you just grunge your way through it and say, well, I finished my 5 chapters, I hope Neil Wong is satisfied. That's the way a lot of guys read the Bible, morally obligated to read 5 chapters, can hardly wait. What? The fourth one has 39 verses. Some notes on how humor is viewed in the Bible. These I'll just mention, and I'll pass on to page 4. Ecclesiastes 2, 1 and 2, it's not an end in itself. Laughter, he said, doesn't do you much good. Doesn't do you much good. It's not an end in itself. Proverbs 15, 13 and 17, 22, along with 15, 15, I'll commend a merry heart. Does you good. Makes your way whole. And that is not necessarily a synonym of humor, but it's close. Ecclesiastes 8:15 says there's nothing better than this, that you enjoy and take pleasure and mirth in the things that God gives you. It warns us in the Old Testament scripture, too, that there are limitations on humor. Merry heart in Proverbs 14:13 does not solve all the problems. Sometimes you get worse because of circumstances about you. And James 5:13 says if you're merry, you ought to go out and sing a song. The concept is that just humor in itself is not the end to which you're appointed. The glory of God is your great end, and the humor is good for you, but to laugh all the time is not what God designed you for. You will take the humor, and you see how many times a situation itself may not be humorous, but it produces an appreciation in you of the absurd and the incongruities that draw you back to God. and to what real values happen to be. And I will just mention, you have to watch the passages in James and using the tongue right and pass by that. So on the next page, on page 4, I mentioned some places in the Bible that I think are really humorous. That's what I think. I've already mentioned some, and there are a lot more. But here in 1 Kings 20 is one that I've always enjoyed. I don't know how it'll hit you, because we're all different, but I've always enjoyed this in 1 Kings 20. Ben-Hadad, he's the king of Syria. In verse 9, he receives word with regard to what the king of Israel will do and what he won't do. The king of Israel says, I'm not going to do what you want me to do. And in verse 10, Ben-Hadad says, the gods do so unto me and more also, if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for handfuls for all the people of Pharaoh. And you're all going to be knocked at my feet, and there won't even be enough dust in Samaria for my people. That's something to decimate you utterly, utterly, utterly. And then the king of Israel says, verse 11, he says, tell him, let not him that puts, I'll give you a tailor-free handling of this. He says, let not him that puts on the stuff that he makes war with boast like the guy who takes it off. Now there's a humorous touch in that. Now the text, the Hebrew text comes out fairly easily, but I'm paraphrasing here pretty wretchedly, I guess. Don't let the fellow who's putting on his warfare instruments boast like the guy who's taking them off. In other words, the incongruity of life is that until you've fought the battle, you don't know if you're going to win or lose. So if you come out in the ring and dance around specifically, oh boy, 303rd Signal Service Battalion boxing team, which I was a member for many months. They called me Prone Taylor. Met a fellow from Cleveland named Charlie Dilworth. Charlie was what we called an open-handed boxer. He danced around the ring with his arms at his sides. That's all right. And then he would stop, and the other guy would kneel and knock him flat on his back. Charlie would get up and dance around a little bit again. But before every fight, Charlie was going to win in one round, two rounds, three. He never fought more than three. And before every fight he was going to win, he'd often go to the other corner and look at the fellow and say, I feel sorry for you having to fight me tonight. But he rarely ever did any more than dance. And we'd bring him home after the bout, back to the barracks at Camp San Luis Obispo, and Charlie would say, when's the next fight? He was born punch drunk. But whatever the case happened to be, you see, the king says to him, it doesn't sound funny, but it's quite humorous. He said, listen, fella. He said, don't boast when you put your armor on like you do when you take it off. And this king is not one of the great heroes of Israel. He's not one of the great men that trust God. I always said that's a note of humor along those lines. And when I mentioned these proverbs, I put four of them together. These are the contentious wife proverbs. I'm not sure what they're going to do with these when the National Council comes out with its non-sex Bible. I'm not sure how they're going to handle this. I'm not sure how they're going to handle this, but they'll have to do something, because these are really, if it's bad to call God he, I hate to tell you what it is in these verses. Now, the writer says it's better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. And there are basically four proverbs that say that basic same thing. And my wife says the only reason it says a brawling woman is because a man wrote this book. in a good sense, see. And we look at those and say, well, is there humor there? Yeah, there's humor there. Because the incongruity of life is that people think if they've got a big meal and a big house, they've got everything. But if they're married to a brawling woman, it's not going to go so well. And every time I read those proverbs, I'm thankful I'm not married that way. I'm in that category of he that findeth a good wife findeth a good thing. But that kind of a concept is a humorous concept designed to point out a truth. You stop and look at it and think about it. And I always mention Proverbs 11:22, which is a little different. But Proverbs 11:22 is one of those contrasting proverbs. And the writer says, as a jewel of gold in a swine snout, so is a fair woman with her out of discretion. You see a swine with a jewel of gold on its nose. That, he says, is like a fair woman without discretion. And there's an enormous amount of humor in that particular thing. Who's going to put a gold ornament in a swine's nose? Well, we used to put rings in them, but they were made out of copper. Maybe they look like gold. No, they turn green. Whatever the case happens to be, the irony is in that particular sort of proverb. I mentioned also the passage in 1 Corinthians 4:8. When you come to the New Testament, some Christians think it's lifeless. But I'll tell you, here's a section in which the satirical nature of the apostle does a great job on these carnal ones at Corinth. And Paul wants to know in verse 7, who makes them differ from one to another? He said, what do you have you didn't receive? And if you received it, why do you glory like you didn't receive it? Huh, he says, you're full. You're rich. You've reigned as kings without us. I would to God you did reign, that we might also reign with you. And then he goes ahead to discuss the apostolic life. And it's certainly not a joke, but it certainly is humorous. You think you are all these things. You swell that bag of whatever. And a fellow said to me one day, he said, I'm only interested in the practices of the New Testament church for our fellowship. He said, I'm only interested in the practices of the New Testament church for our fellowship. And I said, well, which New Testament church practices are you in favor of? The ones at Corinth or the ones at Galatia? Which ones are you really in favor of? And he has not spoken well to me for a long time. But see, because you see, I used humor to hurt there. I've done that a lot. I'm trying to improve. I hope by the time they bury me, they can say he made a little progress. Because when you use those things to hurt, you don't really accomplish your goal. What should I have said to him? I should have said to him, that's nice. I didn't have to say anything else. Later, we could have discussed it over 18 cups of coffee in the days when I drank coffee. I mentioned the ministry of Jesus. Why, there's a lot of humor. This passage in Luke 9, well, look at the passage in Luke 14, 15 through 24, and compare it with 9, 57 through 62. And Luke 9 at verse 14. Many a Christian has smiled at this, and many people have said, weren't they dumb? I mean, look at the one in 14, where you have the feast put out before the individuals. In 14 of 15 through 24. Well, he says, a certain man, verse 16, made a great supper and bad night. Sends a servant out to get him. And the servant goes out and he says, money, he said, I've bought a piece of ground. I've got to go and see it. Another has 5 yoke of oxen. I've got to go test them. Another says, I've married a wife and I can't come. You remember the Catholic girls sang about that years ago. He said, all those things. And the master is really irritated, but when we read it, we say, who in his right mind, when the great master bids you to a feast, looks up and says, well, I've got to go out and plow the oxen first. Who in his right mind does that? If Mr. Clark says, will you come up to the office and have a cracker with me? I'm on my way. Who in his right mind does those things? And the only type of people who do those things, the same kind you have in Luke 9, those people who are finding ways to procrastinate from the will of God. And there's a touch of humor in that. Who would be so incongruous as to be out of harmony with what God wanted them to do? The Lord touches on a note of humor in Matthew 7 with regard to the beam and the mote. I shan't read that. There he's talking about working on a brother's eye. And believe it or not, the concept of having a big bird stuck in your eye, a big bird stuck in your eye. Now, one of the free translators, I guess it was the Cotton Patch people, translated that two before in your eye. The Cotton Patch, I'm not sure, but I think that's where I got it. A two before in your eye. Well, you say, that's absurd. Yeah, that's right, that's absurd. And that's just how absurd it is to try to help others when you yourself are not walking with the Lord in a practical sense. Now, whether the camel and the needle's gate fits that category or not, I always leave those to somebody else. I've looked at the rich fool in Luke 12, too. You can just hear him saying, oh, we'll just build more barns and more barns and more barns. And the Lord says, tonight your soul will be required of you. You say, it doesn't sound funny. No, it doesn't sound funny. Humor often doesn't sound funny, but humor draws your attention to the incongruities of life so that you'll see a point of truth. And the point of truth is that people that just speculate forever what they can do with no response to God or his people, they're setting themselves up for a big fall. Think about that guy. I was up in Guelph, the Bible conference some years ago, and I went to study in the chapel building each day in a room that the Iwana kids used. So I was there on Thursday morning. The Iwana kids had been there Wednesday night. And that particular group had drawn pictures of the widow with her knights, you know, and the rich man. And they'd all had to draw. Here I went over to look at one fellow's picture, and it showed a woman, a pretty wretched-looking, going away, and it showed the church in the background, and it showed a big smoke going up, and over the smoke it said, God is pleased. God is pleased, it said. The rich man gave $1,000, but it didn't count. And this woman gave all she had, nothing. And God loved it, he said. I said to myself, somehow that kid has missed something in that story. He's missed the incongruity of life in that story, see? There's no way you can protect yourself against that. And I didn't feel like writing him a note to correct it either. I just looked at it. And I mentioned lastly in this section, this might not strike you at all, but I'm always hit by things like this. The account of the woman with the issue of blood. And it really is a humor in the way it's told, not in what the account is. The account is a serious account. We don't make fun of those accounts. We don't make fun of a blind man. But if we see a blind man who's walking and using a piece of string for his guidance, we might laugh at the piece of string. So in the account of this particular woman in Matthew 9:20, we're just told that she had an issue of blood 12 years. That's all we're told. She was diseased with an issue of blood 12 years. But listen how Mark describes that in Mark 5. Later on, we'll see how Q takes it up, but not right now. In Mark 5, at verse 25, a certain woman which had an issue of blood 12 years, that's good. No, verse 26, and had suffered many things of many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was nothing better, but rather grew worse. Pretty emphatic, don't you think? Now see how Luke describes that over in Luke 8, in Luke 8 at verse 43. Luke 8 at verse 43. A woman having an issue of blood 12 years, which had spent all her living upon physicians, neither could be healed of any. Luke is the doctor. The Holy Spirit inspires the works. They're right, you see. But Luke is the doctor. Well, she spent her money on the physicians, but couldn't be healed. That's Mark. Mark is writing at the impetus of Peter, I think, and Mark says, look, spent everything she had, just got worse and worse. They fleeced her. And although that's in the humor of the account, I've always said there's a lot of that kind of humor in the Bible, too. Things are told from proper perspectives, and they're right, because the Spirit lets them express things in ways that are true in their own language and culture. And I've read that many times. Incidentally, there are a number of other contrasts like that in Luke, where the professional physician sees things from the light of a physician, not from the light of somebody who had just come out of the doctor's office gasping at the size of his bill. A couple of concluding notes. Humor, when it's rightly used, is not used to hurt or disparage. It's a tool of truth. It works through incongruities to provoke the thinking and stimulate the heart. And you can read the rest of those three notes for yourself. Humor is always based on the love of others, because it gets others in a happy way to see a point of truth. That's what it does. And you'll discover lots of humor in the Bible. You won't find many jokes. You'll find a few riddles that may sound like jokes, but you'll discover lots of humor in the Bible. As through the incongruities of life, the Bible writers try to get us to see important points of truth. Well, I've got to answer it. I've got to stop it. Is there one question that I can answer in 10 seconds? Will the refreshments be fresh tonight? No doubt. A month ago, I had a cup of our bottle of Pepsi Cola and sitting in ice box and laughed every minute. It was flatter than the pennies in my pocket. But I loved it. It was free. Any questions? Thank you for coming to Ibry. I'm trying to be at the refreshment center. If you'd like to ask me anything personally, you can. I don't know it all, but I've enjoyed the humor of the Bible, and I've enjoyed the sense of humor that God has given us to enjoy those things. And I personally have found that you can be too funny. I struggle with that, believe it or not. But I've also found that lots of people in the world suddenly see truth when they see it in the sense of a setting of humor, that have gone by it for years and never seen it. I don't offer a bibliography. Zibri, talks are free. And a couple of other things, but I'll be happy to answer any questions privately you'd like to ask when we're done. Let's pray. We thank you, dear Father, for blessing us so in Jesus. And thank you for our fellowship here. We're very thankful for Dr. Newman, the men who work for him and with him to make this fellowship realistic. We pray you bless it and help it to have a great impact for truth in our world. Pray you'd encourage us, Lord, in enjoying your word, appreciating, honoring you as we glorify the Son of God. We pray you fill us with an enthusiasm for the things you've given us so that our hearts might be strengthened and our lives blessed for your honor. Thank you for this gathering tonight, and we pray you encourage us in lives of testimony and blessing in Jesus' name.